But what I'm going to do, I'm going to, with illustrations, try to say something about the history of archaeology in London and suggest a few things about why, you know, why do we have the archaeological infrastructure that we do? Why do we have the recording system that we have? And how we've been influenced by the environment that we work in, the construction environment, and so on. And also influenced by the type of archaeology which we have in London, which tends to be quite wet, with very good survival of timber and environmental evidence. And then I'll go on and say a few things about our hierarchical, processual recording system, contexts and groups and that sort of thing. At which point I'll stop and my colleague will talk about some of the digital aspects and information systems. So that's what I'm going to try to do, see how I get on. Now, London archaeology was very much influenced by, originally by antiquaries and the hobby of archaeology, a gentleman's archaeology of the 19th century. And as you can see in this picture, there's a very grand tradition of archaeological interest, the grand tour to Italy and so on, but also it had a big influence in London, especially to do with Roman London. The interesting aspect, of course, is that there was an interest almost exclusively in things like Roman mosaics and masonry buildings and the very obvious physical residue of those periods, and a lot of the very detailed, very ephemeral archaeology simply wasn't noticed, or if it was, it was considered too complicated to bother with. Now, obviously things have changed a lot, and skipping right to what we do, how we're doing recently, we've developed, I'll show this, we've developed a very complicated archaeological recording system and an archaeological process. But there is today a very, very strong interest, public interest in archaeology. Archaeology is the new cooking, the new gardening program. The public love archaeology. There are television programs about archaeology. And we are aware that we need to not just satisfy academic desires to analyze archaeology, but to give something back to the general public through the interpretation of very basic things which are interesting to us as well, such as what did Roman London look like? So recently, we've done an exhibition, for instance, and this is a scene from it, trying to give an idea, the ideas that we have of what early Roman London is like go very much against what people assume about Roman buildings and Roman culture. It was very much more a timber frontier town, for instance, in the first century. Okay, that's an image showing central London, aerial view, and London being a huge city, dominant city in Britain, has been the subject of constant rebuilding, and there are only some traces of the original Roman town still visible, bits of the city walls, little bits of the street pattern. Much more of the street pattern you see there reflects a medieval street pattern, which is very, very different from the Roman street pattern. But the main thing about London is that it's a multi-period, very large urban area that's been occupied mostly for 2,000 years. Now, that's back to front, it doesn't matter. Okay, thank you. In the 1950s and 1960s, there is a growing awareness that London's archaeological resource was being slowly but surely destroyed. And it led to things like this map, where the red areas are showing the total area of the city, the old Roman and medieval centre of London, which it was felt had been completely destroyed by deep basement construction by the early 1970s. And this meant that there was a real, it was felt there was a real crisis. There was no archaeological infrastructure to deal with this. There was volunteer work going on. But obviously in this cartoon, people were becoming aware that obviously deep basement development means all of the archaeological resource, finite resource, is going to be destroyed. And something needed to be done about it. Here's an example of the rather typical situation in the 1950s and 1960s. That's a Roman apsidal end of a caldera, a large Roman public bath building being bulldozed with the entire archaeological field unit of the time visible towards the bottom of the photograph. One archaeologist, who I believe had a very small grant from the Corporation of London, and a few volunteers. And it was quite famous that the Corporation of London were quite hostile to archaeological work because they saw it as an impediment to economic process progress. Now, that is a photograph of the same apsidal feature in 1989, about 40 years later, which had not been entirely bulldozed away. And this is a site which I supervised, a very important site where we were able to go back in 1989 with a big archaeological, professional archaeological field team and record what was left of this public bathhouse in great detail. And one of the very interesting things about London and about the systems that we've developed is that it's a jigsaw puzzle of archaeological excavations. Every year, dozens and dozens of excavations, sometimes on the same site as some earlier excavation decades before. So we're building up pieces of the picture all the time, making it very, very important that we have comparable methods and good surveying so we know exactly where different observations go, because quite often they are going to fit together very closely. And this is, in fact, just an example of that. When we did a very large excavation at Poultry in 1995-6, shown by that dark red triangle, all of the pink areas, if you can make them out around, are earlier archaeological excavations done by us or done by people in the 1950s. So basically, there's a huge amount of information which is slowly being built up, and we can compare what we find on any site with earlier findings. And I was saying about the character of London archaeology. There's a lot of timber and tremendous survival. That's a first century warehouse in Southwark, which is a big suburb on the south side of the Thames. It was a slightly sunken structure with a ramp into it, and it was probably used for the storage of cask and amphora based products that were being imported from the continent. And as you can see, the level of survival of the timber is absolutely perfect. Also, I mean, this is a road, no stone slabs. It's very, very utilitarian. It's just gravel. It means that quite often, this is quite clear evidence, but quite often the evidence, because of later activity, is quite truncated or partial or difficult to quickly understand. And that, as a result, the recording systems that we have built up and the detail in our recording systems reflect the fact that quite often the archaeology is very complicated, very difficult to immediately recognize. And therefore, we've always felt we need a very detailed record of what what we're seeing, even if we don't know what it is. Now this is a Victorian building. Until recently, Victorian buildings were considered to be not worthy of being preserved and would be demolished. There's been a huge amount of redevelopment in London. Quite a lot of speculative property development has a very short life cycle, 25 or 30 years. So it means that there's a very high level of archaeological intervention going on all the time. So for instance, the building we just saw and 22 similar buildings were recently demolished and replaced by this building, which some people like, but most people don't. And again, this is an interesting view. This is an archaeological site in the foreground, a very big archaeological site, which we finished a couple of years ago. And again, you can see that we're working in a construction environment, meaning that we've had to develop a professional and very business-like archaeological service to work within that environment. Otherwise, we would simply not be allowed to work. And that means that the property developer is both enemy and friend, because property developers pay for all of the archaeological work which takes place. Up until 1990, they largely did that on a voluntary basis, although their arms would be twisted sometimes. Since 1990, and the passing of government legislation, a thing called PPG 16, it's been in the legislative process. So this is very amusing, because this is a Hammersons, a very large property developer, very business-like in their dealings with everybody. They had to pay for the extensive excavation of that Roman bathhouse, which I mentioned. And when they advertised the new office building, which sits on top of the bathhouse, they showed that they did have a sense of humor and did this advert in the front of the Estates Gazette, which is like the British construction industry's top magazine. Using this carry-on, would you like to invest in an old Roman plot idea, which I thought was lovely. And as I said, money for a developer, time is money. These are Roman coins, but it doesn't matter what kind of money. For a property developer, time is money, and therefore archaeologists are very bad news. That means that we've had to develop some quite innovative ways of digging sites, such as top-down archaeology. So at Portree, for instance, we sacrificed 5% of the site to allow the construction company to put the main pile casings in the ground so that they could build the ground floor slab, and that served as a crash deck above our heads so that we could work and excavate the basements of a new office building whilst the superstructure was built at the same time above us. That meant that we were able to spend two years on the site. The alternative to give the site to us for 2 years was simply not going to be accepted by the owner, who would have said that the entire development was no longer economic. And in fact, that's just an example from the same site of how we had to work with a construction company to program the archaeological work to be phased in to the main construction work of building steel and concrete columns and building the floors and moving 10,000 cubic meters of dirt around the site and so on. Now, the archaeological teams that we use in London, as a result, tend to look more like construction teams. We do all of our own excavation. And here you can see we have an archaeological team working on excavating a ventilation shaft on a new subway line. And in this case, we excavated, using single context planning, an 8 meter deep stratigraphic sequence in, I think we have 16 weeks to do it. But basically, we did all of the work except putting in the concrete shoring system around the sides, which we would leave the site for a half day whilst a specialist construction crew would come in and put that shoring in around the edges. Otherwise, we excavated it. And that's an excavation team. Obviously, the size of the excavation team varies. It goes up and down depending on the amount of work. But we have quite large teams of professional archaeologists, quite badly paid and unhappy for most of the time, as is the lot of archaeologists. But also, because of the system we use, a very democratic system, in that of that team of about 50 archaeologists, each individual digger is responsible for doing their own identification of stratigraphy, filling out all of the record sheets, doing their own scale drawings, and keeping track of the stratigraphic matrix. The supervisor will check that material, but each member of the team is responsible for creating the record. Now, this is rather complicated, and I won't spend too long on it, but in 1991, after the government legislation changed, there was a move basically to formalize archaeology in the planning process and also to make everything much more explicit in terms of the stages in archaeological work. And a thing called Map 2 was published by English Heritage, or the national body, and that stands for the Management of Archaeological Projects. It's quite a bureaucratic document, but it gives us a guideline of stages that a project should go through, which means that at the beginning, when we will put in a bid to do a site, a developer can, if they like, go out and get tenders in different archaeological contractors. But each contractor will do a desktop or desk-based assessment, and they should talk about the potential of the archaeological remains in the site, in quantity and national significance, regional significance, and other agreed terms. Then, as shown through this process, going down, you will write the project design, you will then decide whether to excavate the site or not. At later stages, there'll be an assessment of what you found, and you will reconsider the findings versus what you said at the beginning, and you will revise the research aims. Then you may go on to do analysis, or you might stop, and then you may go on to publish a book. Or at any stage, if you don't find anything important, of course, you might stop. But it's trying to make the whole process more regular so that the construction industry and the development industry can understand archaeology and therefore support it. Because people will not pay for something which is a risk which they can't quantify and is therefore just seen as a danger. And therefore, we do lots of these things, desktop assessments, desktop reports, a bit like environmental impact assessments. These will have to be paid for by a developer who will be told by the planning authority that they can only get planning permission if they go out and employ an archaeological contractor who is an approved archaeological contractor on a approved list. And commission them to do this work. We quite often, if we have sites with a lot of archaeological material of importance on site, projects will go all the way through and will result in publications and archives. We're doing more and more of this. Here are some examples of recent books. We're publishing around about 10 or a dozen monographs a year in London. It's very important that we produce results. In the 1970s and 80s, we excavated a lot, but we didn't produce very many end results, which basically doesn't make you very many friends when you're trying to do more work. We've also trying to make archaeology understandable. We've done a very large assessment of all of the archaeology in London to try to identify research aims for the future and learn from what we've done in the past. And that's just showing that assessment document. And we have now, very recently, done a thing called a research framework for the future, trying to say, well, we've done a huge amount of excavation. What have we learned? What are the big research questions for the future? We don't want to spend, well, we may want to spend it, but people wouldn't want to give it to us to spend money simply to say that we tend to find buildings which are in a variety of shapes, including circular and rectangular ones, and sometimes square ones. We actually have to move on to big issues. Like, what was the transition between the end of the Roman period and early Saxon London? What were the factors that caused the settlement to shift sideways? That sort of thing. The other huge issue in London and throughout England, and I'm sure here, is the archive. The archaeological work we've been doing in London has created a huge archive, a physical archive of artifacts, and a huge paper archive. Quite often it's been housed in different buildings, orphaned from other parts of it. The building is not accessible for researchers. Sometimes the archive has been locked for lack of money. And very recently, we've been able to open a new facility, which the London Archaeological Archive, in one building. And the idea is to make the entire archive from about 5,000 sites, all of the sites that have ever been dug that we know about in Greater London, to make all of that material really accessible to researchers. And that's going to be going on over the next few years using English Heritage funding. Now, in other ways, there is, for instance, documentary evidence in London. And the documentary evidence goes back to about the 12th century, such as this Agas map. But from the earlier periods, from the early medieval, and this is the same area beneath the Agas map, we have multi-period information about the history of the settlement, which we can only get from archaeology. There are no documents at all. And that's the same area, part of the Roman sequence. And as you can see, the buildings in each of those main periods are in different alignments, very different situation going on. Now this is a bit of a mosaic floor. Obviously, we do have some very clear, you know, Italian-style archaeology in London, like that. But a lot of it is very, very much material which you find in keyhole excavations, very small excavations. We're not able to see the entire building or the entire insula. We only see very small parts of it. And therefore, we have to, even if it's rather boring to do it, we have to make a very detailed record and hope that we may, or some future generation, somebody else, will excavate the rest of the building and be able, putting it together, to understand a bigger picture. That's just an example of the detail. That's a collapsed Roman building, a wattle and daub partition in a Roman building, which allows us to do those sorts of reconstructions of what ordinary housing may have been like, the sort of thing that we know very little about except from archaeology. And it allows us to sometimes jump to some interesting conclusions. I mean, that's not London, obviously, that's Herculaneum. But we're able, although London was on the periphery of the Roman Empire, we're able to see it's a very big settlement. And in many ways, it's the density of development and its commercial activity. It makes it very similar, very comparable in some ways to an Italian town like Herculaneum. Now, Roman London was abandoned in the 5th century, and this is one of the areas where I suppose our recording system has had to develop to really understand some very odd things about the archaeological record, such as what's missing from the archaeological record, what has abandonment and erosion and soil processes done to what used to be there. So in this artist's view, we have an idea that the town went back to nature for a time, and the buildings and walls crumbled, and soil formed, and some of the timber buildings actually just turned into soil. So here, for instance, we're doing very detailed recording of basically dark soils with very ephemeral bits of late Saxon buildings overlying the amphitheatre. When we were recording this material, it really didn't make any sense to us at all. But after we finished the excavation and did the analysis, we could see that we had faint evidence of late Saxon buildings built inside the old Roman arena, and we could see how they were set out, influenced by the shape of the underlying features. So, I suppose, finally, I'll show you a few overheads, and then I'll stop. We're trying to get an idea of the function and the dynamics of the town, whilst also recording it in a lot of detail, which is allowing us to say things that are interesting to archaeologists, but also to the general public, like, you know, early Roman London being rather like a frontier town, for instance, and late Roman London being very different, as shown in that view. I think that's all the slides.
Yes.
Now I'll just show you a few overheads. I'm doing well here, aren't I? I'm shocked. Ken, that's a bit faint. I don't know if you can make that faint. That's an example of a context sheet, the Museum of London Archaeology Service context sheet. But basically, we excavate our sites trying to break them down to the smallest constituent parts, which we call contexts. I think the Italians tend to call these things loci. But I don't know what you call them here. Mm-hmm. Now, that's basically the top part of that, which is filled out by the archaeologist, just basically describing the layer of soil that they've identified. A basic description which ought to be comparable, so that one archaeologist does a comparable description to another archaeologist. Very importantly, you'll see the stratigraphic matrix in the middle, and that will all go towards a much bigger stratigraphic matrix. And even more importantly, underneath that, you'll see a line that says, your interpretation. And it's very, very important in the way that we work that all of the archaeological field team don't just record things, but actually say what they think is going on. And if they think that a layer of soil is the makeup for a building or demolition debris, we really want them to say it, because it's the only opportunity to say what we think it all means. We can't go back and look at that layer, because we basically dismantle the archaeological sequence as we excavate on both sites. So we would fill in the context sheet a bit like that. And we still use basic paper records on site mostly. We can have in sites, some sites have 20,000 contexts, 50,000 contexts, although most sites are much smaller. But it makes for quite a big database. Now, And the matrix, so that's just showing a bit. We can use computer systems to generate these matrices. We normally think up to 500 you can remember. But when you get up to 5,000, you really need some IT to understand them. So we generate matrices this way. And we then, basically, we have to assess all of this information and put it back together, having dismantled the site down into its components. Can we build up again in a reasonably objective way? So we have this hierarchy where the contexts will be put together in what we call subgroups, and those will be put together into larger groups, and they will go to make what we call land uses, but basically buildings or structures. They will go to periods and so on. So we're taking different levels of detail to try to make the archaeology of the site digestible, I suppose you could say, understandable. So in a very basic way, you might have a few layers of pit and some fills. We will put those together into little subgroups where we know that things absolutely must be associated with one event in the past. There's no possibility of them being separate events. We don't make any assumptions. We know that the fills in the pit must be related. If half of the pit is separated by a later truncation, like a pipe trench in a dream, we would put the other half of the pit in a different subgroup, even if we're 100% certain it's the same pit. So, there's a subgroup, a pit, and some fills in the pit, marvelous. We then might put those together, several pits and their fills, as a group of pits. Now at this stage, to do this, we must know the dating evidence. What are the dates of the finds of pottery from the different pits? It would be rather unfortunate to put a Roman, a Saxon, and a medieval pit together in the same group. So at this stage, we've gone to a higher level where we need access to a lot more information. The subgrouping, we don't even need to know about the finds. It's just a technical thing. And then, where it starts to get very interesting, we can have a land use. Now, there are pits. Now, we were at this level of interpretation, we think that those pits are in a yard, and they're next to this building, these walls. And the walls have been in subgroups, put into groups, and then interpreted to be part of the building. So at this point, we have a building, and we have some pits in the yard, and we're at a level where we just about put it all back together, where it makes sense again. So that's just our little hierarchy. Subgroup, group, land use, period. I won't read it all out. I think I've said it already. And then, at the same time, we will put all of this information in a database. So we use Oracle, but we could use other databases. But basically, we put that information into a relational database where we can manipulate it quickly. So here you can see we have a site code just there. And you can see we've got a group, and it's in that's an open area, basically like a yard or a field. And I will not tell you about the land use processes. I'll let Pete do that. And then we'll say that maybe we're in periods, and the periods might be quite arbitrary, based on the archaeological sequence of period might be what happened after, say, a fire burned down that part of the town. You know, you have different period definitions of different sites, basically. And at the same time, we'll get the plan data, the spatial data, we'll go through a similar process of being put back together so that we have buildings and roads and, you know, whatever is going on, we'll have a spatial representation of it to go with the text. So basically, this is map two again. So basically, in this case, we've gone through partly down there, we've assessed the site, we've analyzed it, and we would be at the point where we're going to put all this together in some kind of publication. Now to get there, just going back, I'll just show you some of the kinds of research aims we talk about. At the beginning of a project, you may have some general research aims, like, did anybody live here in the past? Now, if that's your only research aim in London, you're probably going to get short shrift. But there'll be a mixture of broad and very specific research aims. Here we're looking for industrial evidence in part of the Roman town, for instance. Like 2.3 there, what evidence is there for industrial activity? Once you excavate the site, and you're looking at the potential, you're able to say a bit more. Skip that one. The Roman evidence, you should be able to see quite a lot more once you've excavated the site. So, industrial activity, we have overwhelming evidence, it says here, for pottery manufacture on the site. That's a research aim that's turned into something that is probably worth publishing. This is rather bureaucratic, but it makes people go through a process in an orderly way. So you may have revised research aims then to go on. In 2.3, we now want to compare the evidence for industrial activity in this site with other sites in the vicinity. So we're at each stage of justifying what we want to do and what we want to spend the money that the developer is giving us on. I went through that very fast. Sorry about that. If I've lost you, but I think we'll probably have a chance to have a few questions or something afterwards. So I'll hand over to Pete. Was that good? Okay. Thank you.
Everyone's already switched off. You should switch off the overhead with the yellow button.
Sorry?
Switch off the overhead front. Yep. That's it.
Right, okay. What I would like to do is to just talk a little bit more detail about the specific issue of strategic risk. Sorry. Multimedia presentation, that's the sound. And specifically, how we can use it as an analytical tool and what we can actually do with it. I'm going to have a look at a large site we're currently working with post-excavation. In fact, we've got to go back and do some more work on it. Large medieval cemetery just to the north of the city of London. And I want to begin, though, by looking at the effect of applying certain technologies can be to archaeology, what you have to be aware of when you're applying computing technologies developed in different disciplines to archaeological problems, what sort of theoretical baggage they come with. But this question is something I want to sort of come back to during the course and have as a theme during the course of the talk. Now, to start off with, the stratigraphic data. Pete's already shown you a picture of a matrix. Where does it all start? Well, for the archaeologist amongst you, that's a fairly sort of a common site. It's a section through some archaeological strata. You can't see it very well on that picture, but all these things have got their context numbers as Peter has indicated. And it has been described as the only unequivocal data that ever comes from an archaeological site by Martin Carver in 1979. And of course, that word unequivocal immediately gets one into the question of objective, subjective. Is that something which a stratigraphic relationship is something that everyone would record in the same way? The context sheets that Peter showed you earlier on, you saw at the top a number of things, of checks that people were going through. They were recording the colour, they were recording the quality of the components within the inclusions within the context, its extent and so on. A lot of these questions are asked so that people are going through the process of trying to identify a difference between two units of stratification, because the identification, the atomization, if you like, of these things is so important to the rest of the process. So we have a very structured approach, a processional approach, if you like, to the recording of these things. But I do believe it is important for us, the Museum of London, as a well-known body that applies such methods, to have a stance and a reaction to the post-processional critique, and not to sort of be embarrassed in any way that we're not applying a more holistic or more freer kind of approach to the archaeology. I think there's been an accusation that certain amounts of discipline and structure in the recording process can stifle innovation, can stifle the identification of new and interesting type of information. I went down to a site today and I picked up some pottery and I've done some analysis on it. It turns out that the smell of the pottery is a really important bit of information we've got to capture, okay? And it can tell us a great deal about who's the last person to use it and whether they had a decent meal the night before or something like that. If that's going to be an important bit of information, then you have to exercise a discipline for it to be realised, for it to go beyond an idea. It has to be recorded in all further cases within a project for you to then have some information to actually base a statement that it's worth recording the smell of a piece of pottery at any future date. So only by exercising certain disciplines do you get the benefit of it. And the other point is that while we use certain structured recording techniques and structured database systems, which you saw a rather old slide of, I have to say, just now, the point is, it doesn't stifle innovation, it is just managing that innovation. In a large archaeological unit like MoLAS, if people were applying and creating data structures to record their own particular set of variables, classically this happens, a lot of work's been done in Denmark in prehistoric contexts, and people are recording a lot of work on lithic artifacts. And systems have been created whereby people can decide which attributes to record of in a particular data set. If you're trying to process that information, you're trying to make general statements about it, if you don't have discipline in this recording process, then it causes absolute chaos during post-excavation in this sort of situation. So the sceptre of relativism that can be thrown at the sort of worst excesses of the post-processional discussion can be countered by the application of discipline, but where innovation is managed and it is brought forward in a structured way. So the point, coming back to systems and computing systems in particular, is that the post-processional debate and the whole business of the subjectivity of the observer, I believe, can be sort of boiled down to a fairly neat point, which is that computer systems, they have parentage, they have their own roots from which they have come, they've been born of earlier applications which made certain assumptions and certain physical data structures and system structures. and therefore they bring a certain type and view onto any data they're looking at, just like a person. An encapsulation of certain approaches that make certain assumptions generate certain views. Well, you can describe a person like that. They've got certain background, a certain history, a certain cultural outlook on life. They can bring that to the interpretation. So I think the main point is that techniques, systems, are as much observers and as much theory laden as the people doing the observations in the first place. One example of this, even in the field of geographic information systems and archaeology, they were they really started making an impact within archaeology in North America, where there was a lot of wide-scale site modelling, predictive modelling of site locations, and the charge has been made against them that they really accentuate environmental factors for location. So environmental determinism was what was thrown at them as being a negative thing, because you know that's what they're looking at. Why were they doing that? The reason they're doing that is that GIS systems are very good at analysing that sort of information. So it was skewing the archaeological debate in the direction of assessing the distance to water, the type of soil, and the slope that you have, and the type of vegetation, and so forth. And it was accentuating those in the consciousness, if you like, of why sites might have been located in a certain place. Now, another example of this is the technique of stratigraphic excavation, and where that came from, and where that started, and how that was a technique imported from another discipline, another set of understanding. And that's something we've had to modify. So, late 19th century geological notions, strata going from miles underground, no residuality, no intrusivity, very simple idea. The 1920s, in England, especially the work of Wheeler and Kenyon, the emphasis very much on the section, these great sites with upstanding bolts, which people can come along and draw any number of sections on. 50s and 50s and 60s, and I should say, this is a very brick-centric view of this. I mean, there are other issues that themes going on in other countries. But certainly in England, 50s and 60s saw large open air excavations, especially of Anglo-Saxon palaces at Yeovil and places like that. Brian Hope Taylor, and in London, the archive of Professor Grimes, who did a lot of work during this period. Open air, good. Composite panels, not so good. If you don't know what these are, they're simply where the excavator decides that a period has been reached within the excavation and all the features currently exposed were a contemporary land surface. And so the excavation was stopped and the whole thing was planned. This is not how we do things these days if we can help it. And then in the late 20th century, 1970, to be precise, the archaeological version of what started off 100 years before as an inherited geological technique was itemized by Edward Harris, and he came up with the laws that define an archaeological as opposed to a geological stratigraphy: superposition, original horizontality, original continuity, stratigraphic succession. The upper are younger than the lower, original horizontality and continuity, and unless otherwise confined, in some way things will tend to have a level surface and thin out to a feather edge. And stratigraphic succession, which is the description of a stratigraphic matrix. In other words, a unit stratification takes its place below the undermost of features which are above it and above the uppermost features which are below it, you can get around that. And it was rather nicely described in that quote there, undesignedly commemorative, referencing earlier work by Lyell, who was credited as being one of the fathers of modern geology, who introduced the concept of deep time within geological studies, in terms of the age of the Earth. Human beings have a perverse ability to produce an undesigned commemorative deposits. We spend all our time digging up. So, conceptually, where does this discussion get us? We view excavation as a process of division. The whole site is something you then take apart in a very organized way. Consequently, we view interpretation as aggregation. We just talked about subgroups and groups. These are the building blocks up to higher order entities, which eventually are things like land uses, roads, open areas, which form a part of a debate. And also, data is not captured as a problem or a person's specific act. It's the type of data recorded is not contingent on the person doing the recording. It's fine to talk about the need to again not stifle new ways of looking at things, but equally frequently you don't have a particular thing. You're just recording things, and you need to have a method of dealing with it, so it doesn't get completely reduced to chaos. Finally, the point is that by having a standardised approach to these things, and by having standardised systems to record these things, you're doing your best. It's not optimum, you never will be, but you're doing your best. You're doing your best by future questions and future researchers, because the information you're recording could have collateral information, could have collateral value for other people asking questions you've never thought of. So, yes, and that's the point I made earlier. It's a communal process. Literally, physically, how does that work? That's an interesting point. We have about 20, it's going down rather rapid rate at the moment, 20 or 30 field archaeologists who will be putting information into our Oracle database systems for our field information. They've all got write access to the database, but if someone wants to add in a new code, a new what we call a basic interpretation, post hole, pit, refuse pit, etc., etc., that has to be done through a number of older members of the organisation, like my colleague here, such that a measure of consensus is actually achieved amongst the people who are thinking about it. If everyone can put in their own interpretations, then it could be a recipe for disaster. We need to have some sort of control over that. We're going to now look at the project, Spitalfields Medieval Cemetery. And look at the way in which some of the systems we're using and that are being evolved. Literally, this is work in progress, as all the discussions we were having before I came out. Large Augustinian priory and hospital, in the top left-hand corner is the actual hospital and priory complex, which has been published in the Museum of London, very reasonably priced, I think. And the other areas underneath are different areas which have become available at different times. And if you can see area 3, just here, that's the area we're going to be looking at. But the site in its entirety has yielded, I think, about 13,000 skeletons, a vast percentage of which are Roman, medieval. We have had some Roman burials as well, one of which was particularly spectacular, one of a young woman buried in a beautiful coffin. And what we did on site was we recorded a lot of these things, but we were doing it digitally, individuals, communal burials, and very truncated burials. That one cut off, you can see right in the middle of the temple. And so we had to involve, given the number, remember, 13,000, we had to evolve a working technique that would allow us to do the work quickly enough. Now, in the early 90s, the late 80s, when the whole business of the democratisation of the recording process was going on, which Peter mentioned, whereby, what it boiled down to is that you had your standard archaeologist was able to record all types of context. So they came across a skeleton, they came across a bit of work timber, they came across a pit. You wouldn't have to weary the specialist from the Museum of London and wait half an hour or a day until that person turned up and the excavation was held up. You were prompted for all the salient details about recording a context of that time. We could have used that process, the recording of skeletons using the skeletal recording machine, but with this number of burials, this was not actually practical. So we had to involve people like my colleague Jessica there, total station, hand computer, she's holding there. How do we do it? We started off by putting in control network all the way around the site. The point is that we view the whole archaeology of London as one big jigsaw, and only if you can articulate your piece of the jigsaw are you going to be able to make things fit together. A lot of the areas on the map that you saw earlier on were dug at different times, you know, 10, 15 years apart in some cases. They all had to be related together. So we need to tie everything, and we do tie everything into the national grid as a standard sort of practice, which is the Ordnance Survey Group for Great Britain. So we put in our control network, and then we recorded all the salient points, if you like, on each skeleton. And we ended up with 13,000 of these. Now, it's a very simple image. You can probably work out where all the points are, single point, line data, all the way along. But what we wanted to do was we realised we didn't have as rich a record, if you like, as the drawn record, but we captured all the information on this, we backed it up with digital photography, which we could rectify at a later date if we needed to. But what the work I've been doing recently with the post-ex guys on this has revolved around how can we add value to that basic information. So the first thing is that we could put into a GIS and very quickly generate a small triangle in the middle there, but generate a centroid for each burial. It's not rocket science, it's a very easy thing to do in the GIS, but it doesn't deliver a value. You're reducing the amount of data, i.e. all those nodes and lines which are marking out the skeleton, but the amount of information in terms of where that skeleton is appearing on is the same. We're going to have a look at how that can be used in a minute. But what we were also able to do was use the same technique, not at an individual level, but at an individual bone level. And again, it's the same thing. You're effectively drawing an orthogonal minimum bounding box around each of those elements and getting the centre of it. Why was that useful? Well, what that meant we could do is that we could fit a regression line between all of those points. A regression line, if you're not familiar, that's simply, first of all, a regression line, that is simply a line from which, if you imagine a right angle turned off the line to each of the points, and you're summing up the squared differences, it's going through all of those points such that the sum of those differences is minimized. In other words, it's drawing a good line through all the points. Okay? And that gave us an orientation for each burial, which wasn't recorded on site as a matter of practice. And then, and I have to make an admission here, we've been talking about the importance of discipline and decent recording systems. It turned out on this site, for some reason, we had yet to get to the bottom of. While they were recording grave outlines for most of the burials, there was one area where they just thought they wouldn't do it for some time. So we had a little exercise in how to create them. And this is what we came up with. It's simply a matter of trigonometry. Once you've got your alignment point, you can simply just turn right angles off. You decide on a rough, on a value for the width of each grave, and then you can draw your set of grave outlines. So, why were they useful? That's the big question. Was it all worthwhile? Let's see. Now, this is an online demonstration, so I found a breakdown at some point. Not that appear there. Right. Okay. That's enough today. Okay, so that was the non-burial context of Area 3 that you saw right at the beginning. And just to give you an idea of what that area looks like, these are all the burials that we have. Now, there are certain areas there which I'll point out now, since they're relevant. Charnel House, late 13th century, one of the try and find on the site, full of burials, but beautiful vaulted archway. And then up here, the pulpit cross, which we know was a late 13th century feature, and there's certain documentary evidence for its use, but we don't know exactly when it came into use. We'll refer to that later on. And then there are other areas you can see, like at the top in the middle, where there was certain features, I believe that was a toilet from 1921, which stopped excavations being seen in those areas. So from that, we were able to generate central to each burial, so to turn these off, and we've got that information there. Now, point about the amount of data and the amount of information. There's less data showing that image, but for the purposes of the sorts of questions where you're simply wanting to analyse spatial location for certain things, distribution of age and sex, distribution of combinations of the same, different types of histological characteristics, finds, there weren't a huge amount of finds from the site, sadly, especially datable ones, but whenever you're looking at anything anything like that, you're interested in simply where the clusters are occurring. You don't need to see the whole burial in each case. And as you can see, it's very complicated if you're looking at everything at once. And just to sort of show you what this was looking like in the central area context, the orientation lines that you were able to form, we were able to pull up the outside size context, to give you an idea of the amount of new outlines which were actually generated. These are the areas where they didn't record the grade outlines for the unknown reason. And then also what we were able to do using the techniques that we've already seen is isolate the multiple graves, which are a great deal, large death events. These were, zoom in on one, these were sort of, so you see the multiple incubations going on. And from those images, we're also able to create final polygons which summarised all that information. So there were many burials within each of these. A line that's some great outlines. Well, why were they valuable? Okay, there's a number of answers which can be given, and obviously there is a classic difference between pagan Roman burials and medieval burials, and Christians think it's buried east west, but they're more subtle information that we're keen on looking at. 99% of medieval burials we really worked on buried east west, and they've got their head to the west end. 1% of them are buried east west, and they've got their head to the east end. The assumption we made, this is possibly to their priests, but there is as yet no evidence, finds evidence, which is normally a chalice and a pattern, to indicate that these people are actually priests. So what was going on? Another point, going back to here, is remember our little friend the pulpit cross over there. If we are looking at the alignment of burials in this area, it's quite likely that the burials which post-date the building of that little monument are more likely to take it as a point to align against within the burial. So it's possible to look at orientations as a means of identifying features, topographic features in the landscape, which we may not have any way of identifying now. In this case, because we know that there was something there, it could be a way of actually giving them relative dates to the build date of that monument. Another view, another way of making that point, is another priory and cemetery to the north of this one, Stratford Langham, and about 3 or 4 miles north of London. 14th century, very smelly place to be at that time, but lots of people were dying there as well. And the point of this slide is just to show that if you look at the burials here, there's a possibility that since they had something to align on along here, that they were aligning quite nicely and the burial lines are pretty good. But as you can see, as they were burying, they were turning around until they were aligned more on the actual church down this way. So the potential for burials to be aligned on certain features in the landscape and for therefore the burial alignment to be diagnostic is indicated. Let's get the PMS. So the biggest problem we had, and we'll look at it again near the end, the biggest problem we had within the medieval cemetery was the classic one of phasing. We had a good stratigraphic record, we had a great deal of context, we had very few data to find. We needed to say to our funding bodies that we could phase this information to a period of something less than 1200 to 1550, which was no good to anyone. We had to try and sort of identify, 100 year groups, they would be great, 50 year groups, that would be even better. So if we can't do that, all we are able to say is that there were lots of people dying between these periods, and percentage of them were females, and percentage of them had arthritis, and so forth. So we needed to come up with some sort of way of phasing the information in the absence of the dating information. So we've got our stratigraphy, our relative dating information, and we've got our orientation information, but we want to look at this. So that's a picture of the matrix. That happens to be a matrix, the matrix of the image you saw at the beginning, that I'm expecting you to make with it. But in terms of the sort of history, the archaeology of stratigraphic matrix processing by computer, if you like, it went through a number of stages. Their primary interest has been initially in the checking of the topology. So there we've just got a simple example of the three most typical errors which occur in these matrices, i.e. direct loops, which is 1 is over 2 is over 1. Redundant loops, the node at the bottom of the middle image is stratigraphically beneath the node at the top. And you know that simply by the route down the left-hand side of the diagram. Therefore, the right-hand indication is irrelevant. In stratigraphic terms, that's an irrelevant information. And the infamous indirect loop, which is 1 is over 2 is over 3 is over 4 is over 1, which is again an illogical possibility. So history, computing applied to processing, it started off like a lot of archaeological techniques on computers in the mainframe of the university. Emphasis was on the checking. By the 80s, the microcomputers coming along, so it's putting decent processing power, some processing power on the desktop, and the algorithms run on the mainframes were starting to be put into the hands of smaller users. But the emphasis was still on checking and drafting. And then they started going beyond drafting, or in expressing a desire to go beyond drafting and to do more with the stratigraphic information than simply using it as the coding for a Harris matrix to produce three-dimensional images like you saw there. And the typical way that was discussed was by using linked lists and peripheral data sets, in other words, linking out to prepared data sets of the pottery or of the bowl and so on. Another classic case here, in fact, of computer programs which are very good at preparing and running the procedures, which are effectively procedures on a directed graph. You described the archaeological matrix as a as a strongly connected directed graph in terms of graph theory, and this whole concept of nodes and lines of relationships is a mathematical language. Computers are very good at doing that, linking it into other sorts of information and then making sense of that and presenting that was another issue. But current thoughts, if you like, well, I think they're current, is the whole business of trying to look at matrices in three dimensions and doing things with stratigraphy in spite of a Harris matrix, if you like, trying to work the relationships that we have in our system more thoroughly. And what we have, and my particular area of interest is in relational models of stratigraphy. The difference being, relational models exist in relational databases, which is where everything else exists. It's in no way peripheral to any of that other information. So, right, out here, nearly done, don't worry. Just to look out at, turn that off, just to make a quick point about orientations, and indeed any sort of interval level of measurement, any interval data you've got, numeric data that you have, like orientations, you can plot it and you can query it. I want to see all those which have got an orientation of greater than x or less than y. You can play games like doing that. Very quick to do, obviously, which is often an understated benefit of these sorts of systems, and they make jobs which previously you wouldn't have bothered doing because it would take too long. Very easy indeed. But what you can also do is you can look at density surfaces, create density surfaces. So, in other words, you can smooth out some of the idiosyncrasies of the way the site happens to have been disturbed or plundered by Victorian sewers, for example. So, in the case of orientations, we're able to sort of put surfaces over them where we're generalizing really what's happening in some way. And these are very easily generated. You know, you might knock out 10, 20 of these things very easy, just to have a look, see what's going to happen. If you've ever been involved in research, I'm sure you know the phenomena whereby you get so interested in a subject. There are all these little routes you could go down, and you know, your PhD takes 30 years to finish because you sort of get diverted all the time. You can go down a lot of these routes very quickly with modern technology if you've got the data organized in a systematic way. And what you can then do, and this is the bit which might not work, because I think it's working today, but I'll give it a go. Just load some data in. You can find it. It's working, brilliant. Okay, now what we've got here, I'm going to give you a bit now. Three-dimensional matrix. the reason it's valuable is as follows. When you're taking a three-dimensional phenomena like stratigraphy or an archaeological site, and you're trying to present it in a two-dimensional plane, there is a certain amount of data strain within that model, which is manifest, if you like, in the need to draw little crossovers and to have links going in great distances over the matrix. The only way you get around that problem is to have a three-dimensional view of that matrix, because clearly if there's been a stratigraphic impingement between two features at any time, there must be a point where one directly overlies another one. So then if you're in three dimensions, you're always never going to have any crossovers. So I say work in progress. This is a tool. It might not be valuable to talk to a lot of what's going on, but it could have some uses in some circumstances. So you can have a wonderful little thing like that just for making you sick, you know, you can look around it like this. Broadly, because it's a GIS data set and it's not a dumb data set, you can ask all the queries of it that you could ask on a two-dimensional data set. You can ask to look at where all the arthritic females are and whether they're anywhere near that group of burials which had such a... But you're using the XY coordinates, so that's the center point, the you'll get the point in a minute when I go back to the view, but the peak dots are the centre point in the XY plane, but their depth within that model is a product of where they are within the stratigraphy. So how many tree levels they are down in the graph. So may or may not be useful, but it could be a way of it's a way of viewing the data. But interestingly, if we go back to here, and we turn this off, and we turn on our burial centroids. Now you've seen a three-dimensional matrix. If you imagine taking that and looking down at it, okay? You do that, you'll get this image is put underneath that one. Okay? Try to clear this. But this is potentially, it's a completely different view of the stratigraphy. You're looking at it in three dimensions, but from above. If you look at the two-dimensional graph from above, it's just a long thin line. But here, you're looking down. Now, there's a number of things which is immediately pointed out to the senior archaeologist I was discussing with them on the day before I came. So it's a work in progress. There are obviously some links up here where there's a pretty large question of whether they're real, something like that. Very unlikely. But what is interesting, what could be diagnostic, contribute to our understanding of what's going on are two things. One is, if you zoom in on somewhere like this, and we ramp this information here on the basis of something like the tree level, so the deeper within the tree is the larger the dot, okay? So we do this sort of thing. We can see that the matrix, the stratigraphically related components are going in a certain direction. Okay? So, I'll get this right in my head as well. The smallest dots here are at the top of the tree, and beneath them there are other things. So, in terms of the development of the symmetry, it was here, 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 and here. So, this was moving in this direction. And it might give us some information about the way the symmetry developed, the way it developed in relation to, again, other topographical features. Remember that the hospital itself and the church is sort of up there, where it says 3.2, and the types of burial going on there seem to be fairly discrete. This isn't particularly truncated data, you know, there wasn't much stratigraphy there as there was over here. Stratigraphy, I should hasten to add, which was about the depth of me. Okay, so very compact archaeology, which is one of the reasons we look at this three-dimensional model, because you can stretch it out if you look at it in those dimensions. And the other sort of point, the final point really, was that there's the question of continuity of use in the graveyard. There's the whole issue of respect and how long monuments stay there. One can take the tree level as another pseudo height, if you like, and do the same game and play around with to make it a bit more visible surfaces. So that's giving you an indication of where the dense amount of stratigraphy is. Okay, you've got to always remember that it doesn't necessarily mean that it was more long-lived, it's just more intensively used. For the sake of argument, it could be a house with 30 floor levels in it, whereas around the back there wasn't much going on. But it's another way of looking at the same thing. So, in conclusion, I do believe that in London, where the stratigraphy is so complex, that we could be, and should be, and hopefully we are doing a lot more with it than just putting it into the Harris Monument bond seriation package in order to draw matrices. Another point is that all these sorts of things are not what's called in the IT industry a killer application in any way. These are tools which may or may not be of use in certain circumstances. It's not proposed that it's an answer to all ills, or it's applicable in all circumstances. In some circumstances, it could be completely misleading if you're not looking at your your data. And then finally, it's an awareness of, it's an, you need to have an awareness of what the tools that you're applying to archaeological problems can do to your interpretation, how it can spin it in certain directions and encourage you to ask certain questions because the technology is good at answering them.